It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll take a look at efforts to help new moms dealing with depression. First, a federal judicial seat in Wisconsin that's been vacant since 2010 has been filled. Milwaukee attorney Michael Brennan has been appointed to a lifetime seat on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. Wisconsin Senators Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson, Democrat and Republican, respectively, played a significant role in both the seat being open and being filled. And both parties have pointed the finger at the other for the long vacancy. Craig Gilbert is a political reporter and Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
Well, give us some of the background, the history on why this vacancy stayed vacant so long.
Well, you know, it started in 2010 when Judge Terry Evans announced his retirement. And President Obama nominated someone named Victoria Norse to fill this vacancy. 2010, I can't remember what month in 2010 that nomination was made, but the election came around and Russ Feingold and Herb Kohl, who were the two Democratic senators at the time, Russ Feingold lost his reelection bid to Ron Johnson, meaning you now had, instead of two Democratic senators, one Republican and one Democratic senator. And when Ron Johnson came into office, he basically killed the nomination that predated his election, saying he had no input into it. And the reason he was able to kill it was because of something called the blue slip, which has been a tradition in the Senate in recent decades. It actually goes back about 100 years. It hasn't been in practice used exactly the same way through that whole time, but in recent decades it essentially gave a home state senator, including home state senators from the minority party, veto power over judicial nominations. And so we're talking about really nominees that have to be confirmed by the Senate to be federal prosecutors, to be district trial judges at the federal level, and to be appellate judges at the federal level, which is the rung just below the Supreme Court, which is, of all these jobs, is the most sort of important one and the one that tends to, you know, drive the biggest political fights. And in this case, we're talking about the Seventh Circuit in Chicago, which covers three states, including Wisconsin. This is the seat that was designated for a Wisconsin judge to be on it. And once Ron Johnson essentially blocked that nomination, he not only blocked the nomination, but he insisted that the state change the way it vetted its nominations, that change the composition of what had traditionally been a bipartisan commission of appointees by the senators. And he said, I want equal say on this commission as a member of the minority. And he had the leverage because of the blue slip tradition, which again essentially gives the home state senator the ability to stop a nomination. He had the leverage to demand changes in this vetting process, which he did, and that took time because Herb Kohl wasn't agreeing to the changes that Ron Johnson was demanding, and Herb Kohl didn't leave office until the end of 2012. Tammy Baldwin, a Democrat like Herb Kohl, replaces him, and they negotiate more changes, and Tammy Baldwin agrees to these changes. More time passes by, and then a new round of applicants for this seat comes in. There's a lot of twists and turns to this process, but basically the charter of the commission required that anybody who's forwarded to the White House as a nominee has to get five of the six commission members voting for them, and they have to be one of four names that's sent along. And those conditions weren't being met. Tammy Baldwin got frustrated, and she sent all eight names of all eight applicants to the White House, infuriating Ron Johnson. And eventually, the Don Schott, a candidate who had gotten five of the six commissioners to vote for him, was nominated by the White House. And Ron Johnson complained bitterly about this, but eventually consented and decided he wasn't going to block the nomination. But by that time, it was an election year of 2016, and Ron Johnson's Republican colleagues in the Senate refused to act on the Don Schott nomination. They, because the Senate, the Republicans in the Senate wanted to wait until after the presidential election in case a Republican got elected president, so their own party would have a chance to fill the vacancy, which is exactly what happened.
Right. So then they run out the clock. They make it to the election. They keep the Republican majority in the Senate, and they have a Republican president now. Now, that's still 2016, and we're in 2018. So that's still a while with this vacancy open.
Yeah, so now we still have this nominating commission, which is made up of three Republican appointees and three Democratic appointees. So now we have a new round of applicants for this position. It takes a while to work its way through this commission, and nobody gets the five votes that the commission requires to send a name on to the White House. But meanwhile, the White House has identified a candidate it wants to nominate, which is Michael Brennan, a Milwaukee lawyer and a former Milwaukee County Circuit judge. And eventually, the White House nominates Michael Brennan, even though he didn't meet the letter of the commission in terms of getting five out of the six members of the commission to vote for him. Tammy Baldwin now is crying foul, and she refuses to support the nomination. She turns it a negative blue slip, which means essentially she says, I'm going to exercise my veto power. But by now, the Republicans in the Senate majority are changing the policy with respect to these blue slips. This practice of giving home state senators veto power over federal nominees from their own states, the Republican leadership in the Senate decides we're no longer going to play that game. For in the case of these appellate nominees, we're no longer giving home state senators a veto power, which, by the way, was a power that Democrats, when they were in the majority, had given Republican senators like Ron Johnson in the minority. In fact, really, if Ron Johnson did not enjoy this exercise, this veto power, the vacancy would have been filled under Obama because he had 5 or 6 years to do it. So now we have a hearing and we have a vote, and there's a vote on party lines this week, 49-46, only Republicans voting for Michael Brennan. He is now confirmed and ending the longest judicial vacancy in the country at the appellate level, really a symbol of just sort of the breakdown, the partisan breakdown in this process, the partisan bitterness over this process, and also the kind of end of the blue slip tradition. So it's a very tangled tale, essentially what Republicans did once they were in the majority in the Senate and once they was they decided that we're not going to give Democrats in the minority this tool, and we're not going to give home state senators the ability to block our nominees.
Talking to Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about this long vacant appeals court seat battled over by senators from both parties now that appointment has been made and confirmed. Craig, judge appointments, Supreme Court on down, were big issues in the last presidential election. They're big issues in elections in general. People are bringing it up for the Senate race this year. You've been around the state talking to people about how they voted in 2016. Do people talk about, whatever I think of my candidate and my party, hey, they get to appoint the Supreme Court judges, the other judges, this is part of what I base my vote on?
Well, only to a point. I think for some voters, and certainly for activists and for interest groups, this is a huge, huge deal. I don't think it is for the average voter, but it is for some voters, and including a lot of very partisan voters and ideological voters, and it certainly is for activists. It's a very big deal. So for Donald Trump, I think it's a big feather in his cap for conservatives and hardcore Republican voters and certainly activists. The idea of, his ability so far and the ability of Mitch McConnell in the Senate to push through judges for this, especially for this at the appellate level, it's a huge part of their agenda, and it's probably the biggest single thing they've been able to do under President Trump. And it has, it has consequences. It has huge political and judicial importance. At the same time, there's sort of what it means for the U.S. Senate and how the U.S. Senate functions and what it means for the kind of role of home state senators to exercise their influence over nominees from their own states.
And Craig, in our last minute or so, Michael Brennan now has filled this vacant seat. I know judges don't get an R or a D by their name, but is there a background that suggests that he might be a Republican-friendly judge?
Well, he is. He is an advisor to Republican Governor Scott Walker. He actually wrote a letter expressing support for Ron Johnson's use of the blue slip power to scuttle the first Obama nominee for this seat. He did get bipartisan support in Wisconsin within the legal community. He did get a lot of opposition from people, from liberals and Democrats as well. He's not the most controversial nominee you're going to see, and so he's sort of in the tradition, I think in a sort of a broad tradition for judges. He's not exceptional in that regard. I think the issue in his case, even though he did get some liberal opposition on his record, I think the bigger issue for Democrats and for liberals was really the process more than the substance of this nomination and what that means going forward, because, you know, majorities and minorities change. And it could be in the, you know, down the road that it's Republicans in the minority and they're in the position of basically being unable to object or to stop a judicial nominee that they don't like from their own state.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Anytime.
That's Craig Gilbert, political reporter and Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. He joined us today to talk about the recent appointment of a Milwaukee lawyer to a long-vacant Court of Appeals seat and the politics surrounding this and other appointments. Suicide among new mothers is a serious issue that's rarely talked about. According to a 2013 study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, suicide is the second most common cause of mortality in postpartum women. That said, suicide among women following childbirth is still fairly rare compared to the rest of the general population. There are a lot of factors that contribute to the problem. There's no single cause for new mothers, a combination of hormones, life stresses and changes, sometimes a lack of social support. They can all exacerbate feelings of depression. Our next guest is here to explain the pressures facing new mothers and what kind of help is out there. Jennifer Mueller is a counseling psychologist in the Behavioral Health Department for Gunderson Health in Onalaska. Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, how widespread of a concern, a problem, is suicide among women who have given birth recently?
Well, suicide is something that we want to take very seriously, and thank you for talking about this. This is a conversation topic that not enough people are talking about, concerns the sensitivity of it, and it's something that any family who has dealt with it, it's very severe. It's one of the leading causes of death among postpartum women, and so something more people should be talking about.
And is this connected to what we hear about postpartum depression?
Absolutely. There are different levels of mood concerns for women after they've given birth. From the initial, what can be called postpartum blues, those can happen the first few days or a week or two after a baby is born. And that may include feeling overwhelmed, increased crying, some sadness, some anxiety, trouble sleeping. And that can easily turn into what we would consider more of a major depression or postpartum depression. And that can begin anywhere from the first few weeks up to a year after giving birth. And those symptoms can include more of that depressed mood swings, withdrawing from family and friends, a loss of appetite, irritability, feelings of hopelessness, worthlessness, that you're not a good enough mom. And those can continue to escalate, feeling so overwhelmed, feeling that they just can't cope, that they're not good enough, to where thoughts of ending their life can occur.
And I imagine there's got to be kind of a spiral effect here where maybe that new mom or a mom a few months in is thinking, wait, I'm supposed to be happy as a new mom, and I'm not feeling that way, and that would just add to the depression. Is that part of what's going on?
Absolutely, and that doesn't even have to happen. That can happen within the first few days, not even weeks, feeling overwhelmed by the responsibilities of caring for children, feeling that they're just not themselves, that expectation society sometimes has that having a new baby is this happy, joyful time, and that that's not what they're feeling. And so some of the guilt, I'm not feeling what I'm supposed to, or I'm not bonding as I am supposed to be or should be according to what TV movies or maybe family expectations are. And that guilt, some of that irrational thinking can just continue to ride upon the mom, making that depression worse.
Let's talk about the causes of this depression and ultimately leading sometimes to suicide. People might think a lot about hormones and the physical changes that come along with childbirth. This is also a major life change. Patterns disrupted, sleep disrupted, social connections disrupted. There are a lot of things, each of them on their own, that could cause depression.
Absolutely. So that is an important aspect. It's not just one factor. It is that combination of the lack of sleep, of the change in hormones, of the change in lifestyle. It may also have factors of if a woman has a history of depression or anxiety, that may increase her risk of experiencing some postpartum depression. If there's been stressful life events that have occurred during her pregnancy, if she's not experiencing a lot of social support or from her partner, or if there's even been obstetric complications and her own physical recovery, those are some of the signs or potential risk factors that may support a depressive episode.
Talking to Jennifer Mueller from Gunderson Health in Onalaska, talking about depression and suicide for women after they've given birth, soon after or even months after. And Jennifer, I want to spend the bulk of our time talking about what we do about this. And part of it, a point you raised earlier, was about that expectations game. Do we need as a society to be talking about, you know, it isn't always this rosy, happy, sunny picture after birth?
I think that's a very good point, that not everyone is experiencing that glow that we sometimes talk about. And so the expectation that you're not going to feel the same, and that there, the expectation, hopefully, that women are beginning to hear, there is help, that this is a treatable condition, that talking with your family and friends, talking with your doctor, does not make you a bad mom, does not make you crazy, does not mean that they're going to take your children away. It, talking about it, opens up that possibility for support and resources and help.
When women are talking to their doctors as they go through pregnancy, is this part of the conversation? Of course, people are told about, you know, nutrition and sleep and what to watch for in a newborn. Are they talked to by healthcare staff about these maybe warning signs of depression?
I think that there's some information out there, and I would highly encourage women to talk more openly and directly with their doctors, with their family, their partners about it. We talk about having a birth plan of what you want to do during labor and delivery. I encourage women to be proactive about their mental health as well. What may be some signs and symptoms? What are treatment options that they can utilize, from having extra support in the home to the possibility of talking with other new moms, the possibility of therapy or even medication, if that is a necessary option, that they work with their doctor with.
What about people close to a new mom? What can they do, A, to help, and B, to watch maybe for warning signs?
Some warning signs may be just the lack of sleep. Obviously, with newborns, they don't sleep through the night. But if mom is having a hard time napping when baby naps, is not getting adequate nutrition herself, is so highly focused on baby's feeding schedule, if she's not leaving the house, if she's not engaging in some of her usual activities or hobbies, if there's this ongoing theme of anxieties, worries about baby, as well as the repeated themes, I don't feel like myself, I don't feel right. Those are probably some good signs and cues to keep having the conversation and to be so important for family and friends to know, to be direct, ask those questions. Are you feeling down? Are you feeling depressed? Have you had any thoughts of hurting yourself?
For the mom herself or those close to her or healthcare providers for that matter, what are signs that there might be an emergency situation here, that there's a serious physical risk?
Well, absolutely, there can be medical emergencies when it comes to mood, and that tends to involve the very rare postpartum psychosis, in which she is absolutely not feeling like herself. We see the rapid onset of severe mood swings, where behaviors, thought patterns can become very disorganized, where she may be talking about hearing or seeing things that other people don't, having delusions. And these are medical emergencies. They need assistance with the doctors and likely hospitalization to ensure her safety and to get the right type of treatment and medication.
Let's talk about social connections a little, because early in those childhood years, it can be isolating. You're spending a lot of your time, either you're off work at home a lot with the kid, or you come home from work, all your time is devoted to the kid. How important is it to keep those social connections up to help prevent that depression and to have that support network?
It's powerful. Social support can be crucial for a mom, especially a new mom who is apt to be really doubting her abilities. Am I doing something right, wrong? I don't want to be hurting my baby. To be able to connect with other people, to get some options, to talk about some of those concerns. So that may be parenting groups, that may be church groups, that may be just encouraging women to attend their usual social activities with family and friends, to reach out, to stay active. The more isolated they are, the more those thoughts and concerns can become malproductive, and she's not getting the support she needs.
And finally, do we have enough access to mental health diagnosis and especially treatment for those new moms in Wisconsin?
I think when it comes to overall access and treatment of mental health, the answer to me is clearly no. We need to continue to talk about it. Our conversations have encouraged over the years, but that openness, you're not a bad mom if you're feeling down, if you have worries, or if your mood is severely disrupting your mood. And so reaching out, talking with your doctors, there are support groups, there are hotlines, and there are options that are across the country, across our state.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for ongoing conversation about this important topic and safety for our families.
Jennifer Mueller is a counseling psychologist in the Behavioral Health Department for Gunderson Health in Onalaska. She joined us to talk about suicide and depression among women after childbirth, what women can do to stay healthy, and what their friends, family, and doctors can do to support them. If you're having suicidal thoughts or worried about someone close to you, here's the number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That number is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. Von Diaz moved from Puerto Rico to Georgia as a young girl. Food has always played an important role in her life, in both places. On visits to Puerto Rico, where her grandmother was always ready to feed her, when her mother got a second job and Von taught herself to feed the family, and later on, when cooking her way through her grandmother's cherished cookbook. Von Diaz is a writer and radio producer based in New York. She's a self-taught cook who explores Puerto Rican food, culture, and identity through memoir and multimedia. Her new book is Coconuts and Collards, Recipes and Stories from Puerto Rico to the Deep South. Von, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
What are some of your earliest memories you have of food as a kid?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I like to say that I'm a lifetime eater, although I imagine we all are as human beings. Some of my earliest memories of food actually, I think, jump back and forth between Puerto Rico and the South. I write a fair amount in Coconuts and Collards about my early Southern food experiences being, how do you say, a little lacking. Like a lot of kids, some of my earliest food memories happened in public school or in daycare. And so I was often introduced to these kind of subpar versions of Southern cuisine that I then had to unlearn over time. And similarly, when I would go back to Puerto Rico to visit my family as a kid, which we did fairly often, I would say we went back every year or so, I was really taken with how dynamic and vibrant the flavors of Puerto Rican food were, in contrast and sometimes with some similarities to Southern cuisine.
We hear about fusion cuisines a lot these days. It's been a hip thing for restaurants in a while. When you're writing about Puerto Rican cooking, it's always been a fusion of a lot of different cultures, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it would be very difficult for you to break Puerto Rican food down into any single individual culture. You see elements of indigenous techniques and ingredients such as cassava, African ingredients and cooking techniques such as plantains, sort of mashing things and serving them with flavorful paste in addition to rice. And Spanish cuisine, you know, the first colonial force that was in Puerto Rico, in the use of olive oil, a tremendous use of pork and things of that nature. And then you have American influence. So a lot of mayonnaise, a tendency to rely on canned and frozen vegetables as opposed to fresh. And so, you know, as you look at, you know, where you, if you were to go to a Puerto Rican restaurant today, you would see elements of all four of those influences on the same menu. And in that way, its authenticity is its hybridity.
And you talk about going to Puerto Rico, spending the summer there as a kid sometimes, not a completely positive experience. The mosquitoes, I think, found that they really liked you. There were other downsides. But
they
your
did.
Grandma and the cooking and the food, that really made an impression on you.
Absolutely. I mean, I think what's interesting about being a Puerto Rican kid growing up in the South is that Puerto Ricans are not immigrants, right? We are born American citizens, but we have all of the experience of other immigrant kids, the language barriers, the different foods, the different cultures. Kids in the South often made fun of my name or made fun of my hair or the color of my skin. And so when I would go back to Puerto Rico, I experienced the counterpoint to that same kind of lack of belonging. The kids in Puerto Rico often made fun of me because I needed air conditioning and I was sort of addicted to television and I didn't eat in the same ways that they did. And so my grandmother became this really important touch point for me to feel included in both spaces. I write in Coconuts and Collards about how my grandmother was born in the Dominican Republic. And after her father was assassinated during the Trujillo era, her family moved to Biloxi, Mississippi, unusually. She happened to have family there. And so my grandmother had had that experience of being of one place and growing up in the South. And I think that she was really able to relate to how confusing it was to me and how isolated I felt at times. And so food really became this way for she and I to connect and for me to also start to see the similarities between the culture of my homeland and the culture of my home.
Talking to Von Diaz, her new book is Coconuts and Collards, Recipes and Stories from Puerto Rico to the Deep South. I want to get into some of the ingredients you're working with, and one of my favorites, plantains. I was lucky enough to spend some time in Puerto Rico, and it's like the way I think of potatoes, there's like an infinite number of ways to prepare them. Same
Absolutely.
For plantains in Puerto Rico, so many different ways. Can you talk about the role of the plantain?
Definitely. Well, it's important to point out at the top that plantains actually came to Puerto Rico from Africa, which is interesting because plantains, I think, are thought of as synonymous with the Caribbean, not just with Puerto Rico, with Jamaican food and Haitian food, Dominican food and Cuban food. But they actually were an import from African cultures. And something that I try to do in Coconuts and Collards is to give people a little bit of a guide for how to select plantains based on what they're trying to prepare. So, you know, green plantains are typically prepared in a couple of different ways, as tostones. So they're deep fried and then smashed into discs and refried. So they're kind of like chips that you can, you know, stack things on or just eat with a sauce. Somewhere in between green and dark brown are these bright yellow plantains that are sweet, more likely what people are used to in the States, often called maduros. And those can range in color from sort of light yellow to dark yellow with brown spots, which is like a really sweet spot for that kind of plantain. To then the far end of the spectrum, which is when plantains turn almost black because they become super sweet. And that is, for me, my favorite state of the plantain because it's just such a vibrant kind of banana flavor, but with this deep earthiness. Those bananas at that, or plantains at that stage are also really good just sautéed, but can also be mashed and formed into a sweet, savory kind of shepherd's pie with picadillo or ground beef with seasoning in the middle, which is called a pastelón, another recipe that I have in Coconuts and Collards.
My favorite is in that point where, you know, if this thing was a banana, you wouldn't need it. You'd detonate it from a safe distance. That's where I like my plantains to be. My wife likes them greener, and she likes tostones. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the recipes you shared with us. It's a black bean stuffed tostones with avocado sauce. Can you talk us through that recipe?
Sure. So that recipe actually started because I inherited this very specific tool from my grandmother that is a tostones, oftentimes, at least in the Caribbean, are made using an actual press. It's the simplest kind of tool. It's kind of two pieces of wood with a circular section cut out of the middle. And that's where you put the initial deep fried plantain so that it forms into a little, you know, into a circle. My grandmother had this tool that would then take that same tostón and press it so that it becomes a little cup, almost like a tostito scoop, but made of plantain. And I was fascinated by this tool. I have no idea how old it is. It's just a gorgeous little tool, and decided that I wanted to figure out, you know, what would I stuff tostones rellenos with. My grandmother would often stuff them with sardines and capers and lemon, and I wanted to make something vegetarian because you've been to Puerto Rico, you know that vegetarian food is not super common in Puerto Rico. Vegetables aren't an important part of the cuisine, right? But I really wanted my cookbook to have as much vegetarian cuisine in it as possible because I'm not vegetarian, but I love vegetables. So I kind of adapted this, you know, kind of traditional stuffed tostones with a very simple vegetarian black bean filling that, you know, you can make with fresh beans, you can make with canned beans, super simple, few ingredients, and then topped with this avocado sauce that is, to me, just one of the most delicious, simplest things you can do with an avocado. And it's super versatile. So ultimately, you take an avocado, put it in a little food processor with a bit of lemon, a tiny bit of water, some salt and pepper, and it makes this awesome vegan sauce that you can, you know, dip your French fries in if you want to, or put on tacos. And so it felt like this really delicious vegetarian appetizer that is at once filling and also, you know, pretty light.
And we can do that without your grandma's special tool. You're right, with a little plate and a coffee cup, was it?
Exactly. Yeah. So you can do that first step with a coffee cup and then press it in a smaller ramekin with the bottom of a muddler, or, you know, the bottom of your, of a, you know, of a spatula if it's fat enough, to sort of form it into this little, what I did, like a little tostito scoop cup.
We've got that recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday, along with a couple others from our guest. Von Diaz is with us. Her new book is Coconuts and Collards, Recipes and Stories from Puerto Rico to the Deep South. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your experiences with Puerto Rican food? Has food played a role in your identity and learning about your own culture, whatever that might be? Do you have questions about some of the ingredients that might be used in Puerto Rican cooking? Are you a plantain fan? How do you like your plantains, or you need some advice on how to select and cook and eat them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. It's Food Friday. Von Diaz is with us talking about her new cookbook, Coconuts and Collards, Recipes and Stories from Puerto Rico to the Deep South. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have experiences with Puerto Rican food, the great variety of Puerto Rican food out there? Have you had something that you could maybe use some advice on how to recreate it yourself? Do you have questions for our guest, or experiences and stories to share? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Von, it is spring here in Wisconsin. Fresh Brussels sprouts are not too far off. And one of the recipes you shared with us, we can use there, Brussels sprouts with chorizo sofrito. This one looks great. Talk us through this one a little bit.
Absolutely. So I mentioned earlier that my grandmother spent some of her childhood in Biloxi, Mississippi. It is a total casualidad de la vida, as we say in Spanish. It was by chance that she had family there when she and her family had to leave the Dominican Republic. And I believe, although unfortunately I never had the opportunity to ask her this question because later in life she was struck with pretty severe dementia, she, I think, really developed a love for vegetables while living in the South. And one of her favorite vegetables of all time was Brussels sprouts. As you can imagine, Brussels sprouts don't grow in Puerto Rico. They are not part of the cuisine. They are actually pretty difficult to find. And growing up, my mom had all these really funny stories about how my grandmother would try to prepare frozen Brussels sprouts and would try to get her kids to eat it. And her kids just would not eat them. They thought that they were disgusting. Tata, which is what I call my grandmother, just sort of couldn't figure out the right combination of flavors to make her kids actually like her favorite vegetable. Apparently, she loved them anyway. And so when I was coming up with the recipes for coconuts and collards, I wanted to create a recipe that would pay homage to her and her love of Brussels sprouts, but in a way that I was more familiar with preparing them, having grown up in the South and having worked at Southern restaurants. And so the recipe sort of leans on a pretty classic way of preparing Brussels sprouts. You know, oftentimes you either can roast them whole, you can cut them in half and roast them in the oven, or you can slice them as thin as possible and then pan saute them, which is a great way to prepare them because you get to really keep a real kind of fresh texture to the Brussels sprouts, and they cook in a fraction of the time that it takes to roast them in the oven. And so I take that kind of classic simple technique and pair it with what is a recipe that I came up with, chorizo sofrito. So oftentimes in Puerto Rican food, dishes have sofrito in them. It's the, you know, the spice miracle that makes Puerto Rican food taste like Puerto Rican food. And typically it's onions, some kind of bell pepper, or ajicitos, which is a kind of small bell pepper tasting pepper that's sweet, a recao or culantro, and garlic. And you saute that in olive oil, and that's what creates that amazing kind of Puerto Rican, broader Caribbean flavor. Oftentimes when people make their sofrito, they cut up ham or some kind of smoked pork and add that to give the sofrito an additional flavor boost and add kind of this porky richness to it. And so I took that same kind of concept and added chorizo, which is just a personal favorite of mine. And also, I think, kind of a call out to the Spanish influence that's so abundant in Puerto Rican cuisine. And so the dish is kind of a hybrid of my grandmother's, you know, love for the Brussels sprouts, with a very traditional way of preparing any vegetable or meat. In using sofrito and then a little bit of chorizo, and kind of call back on that Spanish influence and give it a little bit of a spicy kick.
Again, that recipe is at WPR.org/Food Friday. And Vaughn, you just mentioned an ingredient that was new to me in reading your cookbook, culantro, not cilantro, culantro.
That's right.
What is that?
So culantro is sometimes called recao, R-E-C-A-O. It's also sometimes referred to as oriental cilantro. It's a long leaf. It kind of looks like dandelion greens, but a little bit less spiky. And it tastes almost like cilantro and parsley had a baby. So it has a little bit of more of an earthiness. I think a little bit less of what people describe as a soapiness that comes with cilantro, and it is a bit of a heartier leaf. So it lends itself really well to cooking versus cilantro, which certainly you can cook with cilantro, but a lot of times you want to add it at the end, you know, as a garnish, so you can really taste that bright, flavorful cilantro taste if you happen to be among those who don't have the gene that makes you hate cilantro, right? Because we know that that's actually a scientific fact. Culantro, on the other hand, you can use it as a garnish in that way, but it really lends itself better to slow cooking and to braises. Oftentimes I'll add whole culantro leaves to my stock, and I find that it really adds this kind of deep earthiness, but with that, the brightness that that cilantro also has.
So Vaughn, growing up and living in the Midwest, I don't know that I've ever knowingly laid eyes on culantro, but you write that if we don't have it accessible to us, maybe just take some cilantro, take some parsley.
Yeah, I have throughout my recipe testing process for coconuts and collards, I would occasionally also, even though I live in New York, where I can typically find culantro very easily, sometimes I couldn't make it to that grocery store. I just didn't have time. And it's just a 1-to-1 ratio, 1 tablespoon of parsley, 1 tablespoon of cilantro, and you get 2 tablespoons of culantro.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Vaughn Diaz, author of Coconuts and Collards, Recipes and Stories from Puerto Rico to the Deep South. Well, I want to finish up our look at the recipes you shared with us. This makes sense with the dessert you sent along. This is a coconut panna cotta. This uses fresh coconut milk. I'll take a stab at the pronunciation, tembleque. Am I close?
Perfect. Yeah.
Yes. All right. Yeah. Well, this looks, I'm looking at the picture right now. It looks fantastic. Tell us about it.
So tembleque is a super common dessert in Puerto Rico. I mean, it's so common that it's made in Jell-O instant pudding form. You go to any bakery in Puerto Rico, be it a small bakery or big grocery store, you're going to find tembleque. It's like pudding. It's like Jell-O. And it is just the simplest, loveliest, freshest dessert. At its core, it's coconut milk, some kind of a stiffening agent. People tend to use cornstarch, sugar. And traditionally, it uses this kind of hard to find ingredient called agua de azar, or orange flower water. And it's that ingredient. I'm not sure how it made its way to Puerto Rico. I'm sure it came from Spanish influence, but I've never investigated it. Is used fairly commonly in Middle Eastern and Persian cuisine. And it's this really bright, floral, aromatic liquid that gives all of these other ingredients, right, the kind of also very rich coconut flavor and the sweetness of the sugar, it gives it this other dimension. And growing up, I ate it all the time. And then, you know, once you prepare it, you dust it with cinnamon. And it's just the most fascinating combination of flavors. It's nutty and floral and sweet and rich at the same time.
Wanted to talk to you about your process of cooking a little bit. Do you sit down and think consciously, I'm going to take Puerto Rican elements and, say, American Southern elements and consciously merge them together? Or does it just kind of flow from your background and your cooking experience and your work with your grandma and all that kind of more naturally?
You know, I think for me, I feel like both of these cultures' foods live side by side in my mind. And I'm not sure if that's because I've just have always been a person that was really interested in food, or I had just kind of the right instructors in both places to really introduce me to the elements of both of these cuisines, so that, you know, it's very likely that if I'm cooking something and I see or smell or imagine an ingredient that I know is commonly used in both places, I'm going to kind of automatically be like, oh, maybe this would also be good. An example of that is a recipe that is in coconuts and collards for a fresh corn catfish chowder. And that recipe came entirely from my mind because it has the flavor base of Puerto Rican cuisine, the sofrito that we just talked about, and also a Puerto Rican stock, but with these very Southern ingredients, kind of funky catfish and fresh corn. And it was an experiment at first. And I was like, there's no way this isn't going to work. All of these ingredients love each other in other areas and in other dishes. And sure enough, when I put them together, they worked. So I think for me, my process is about understanding which ingredients and which processes, despite origin, work really well together. And then when I'm excited to eat a particular thing, say, you know, I wake up one day, I'm like, man, I would really love something with coconut milk in it. Then I have this, you know, kind of vocabulary of all the different things that coconut milk tastes great in, and can kind of pick and choose and see what works really well.
And Vaughn, we just have a couple of moments left. You have an afterword talking about Puerto Rico right now, today, in the aftermath of last year's hurricane. Your thoughts definitely with the people there.
Absolutely. I try to keep in as much contact with my family and friends that remain on the island. To be honest, most of my family members are here on the U.S. mainland, but I do have a few people that I'm very close to, one of whom I speak about a lot in my book. His name is Berto. He owns a tiny restaurant in Yabucoa, which is the town where Hurricane Maria hit, where the eye hit. And his restaurant was completely torn apart. He's spending a tremendous amount of money just keeping his generator running because electricity is in and out all over the island, and it hasn't been fully revived everywhere, right? So it's very difficult to watch my island, which is also part of the United States, continue to struggle in this way without any kind of resolution.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Vaughn Diaz. We've been talking about her book, Coconuts and Collars, Recipes and Stories from Puerto Rico to the Deep South. Thanks to her for joining us. And remember, you can find three of the recipes she shared with us. They are at WPR.org/Food Friday. The most fun federal government report of the year just came out this week. It's the list of the most popular baby names of the previous year, released by the Social Security Administration. If you search online for baby names and Social Security, you can find the most popular names for each year and track the rise and or fall of your own name's popularity over time. Let's get to the big winners now for 2017. For girls, the number one name was Emma. Emma was also number one in 2016 and 2015 and 2014. Emma's been in the top five since 2002. I, for one, welcome our new Emma overlords. After Emma, we have Olivia, Ava, Isabella, and Sophia. Now for boys, the winner is Liam. Liam's been knocking on the door. It's been in second place for 3 years in a row before hitting number one in 2017. Before that, Liam had come out of nowhere. The name wasn't even in the top 100 until 2006. After Liam, you've got Noah, William, James, and Logan. Now, if you're looking for a baby name, might I suggest Robert, coming in at number 65 on last year's list, but maybe due for a comeback. It was number 5 the year I was born. Or how about some Robertas? That hasn't been in the top 1,000 since 1991. You could be the one who brings it back. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.